Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to ATI Financial Radio, a plain English, no-nonsense approach to personal finance. Today is Wednesday, April 15th, tax day, and today's show is Decoding Life Insurance. I'm Dina Isola here with Tony Isola. We want to thank you for joining us this week. What are the different types of life insurance and what kind of coverage gives you the best bang for your buck? Today we're going to decode some of the mysteries of this often misunderstood product, and also we're going to discuss seven ways to teach your teens about money. We're going to get the scoop on oil and learn why prices have been so volatile, and you'll find out what three things you can do right now to protect your beneficiaries. So what's new in our blog this week?
Well, this week's blog has to deal with teens and money. And there's obviously a lot of things that need to be discussed because most adults, never mind teenagers, haven't been taught how to properly handle their money, whether it's their investments, whether it's their debt, whether it's their savings. So we kind of came up with a bunch of different seven ways, basic ways, that really could help teenagers handle their money properly, and also keep them out of getting into bad habits and long-term trouble.
We found, too, that in spite of, you know, classes or courses that kids can take, even if you could find one, that's not really the way they learn about money in the most effective way. What is taught at home, what they see being practiced around them is actually more impactful than any class they could take.
Yeah, the research has proven that, you know, if you have students who actually take financial literacy classes and have adults who are careless and do not manage their money properly in their home, they will really not improve too much from those classes. Obviously, if the adults are doing the right thing and they take the classes, then you have a winning formula. But just taking classes and having poor role models is is not a strategy for success. And you could, if you want to read the whole blog, it's on ATI's Facebook site, which we posted the other day, so you can go on there, and if you haven't gone on there, you should, and you could, you know, friend us, or like our page, actually. We also, it's posted on another site called BrightScope, which kind of gives an impartial view of all many different types of investment advisors, in which we have our names on there, and there's a bunch of articles. If you go on to brightscope.com and type our names in, you'll see a bunch of things come up, including articles and links to the Twitter account and links to Facebook if you haven't already gone on there. And there's another site also called nerdwallet.com, whereas if you type my name in there, you'll see a profile plus links to different, you know, sites, other sites that we're connected to, plus on both, actually on BrightScope and NerdWallet, there is opportunities for you to ask questions to advisors. So if you just have some general questions and you wanted to get a professional opinion on something, you can go on that site or just actually read some of the other questions that have been posted, and you might actually have your answer without having to ask it.
Two other sites where we've been blogging, Tony blogs on maliceforall.com. And I have a blog on realsmartica.com. So if you are on the internet and like to read blogs, those are some good places to go. If you want to email me, dina@atiinvestment.com, I can get you on our mailing list, and you'll know when we have new blogs up because I email people on our list. But let's get back to the seven ways that you can actually teach your teens about money, because the article is really good. I hope you get to look at it, but let's just briefly go over it. One is adult conversations. A lot of times there's a tendency to shield children from adult-like concerns, and yet in doing that, you're not really helping them develop or progress or master the skills that ultimately every single one of our children is going to need to master in order to become a successful adult, regardless of what they end up doing to earn a living. So make sure that you include them. If you're looking at buying a new car, for example, the fact you know, that you're looking at one car versus another and the economics of it and leasing versus buying, for example. It may be a little bit over their head, but it's actually not a bad thing to include them in those types of conversations. Oftentimes, kids look at money decisions as very black and white. We'll just get the bigger, better one, and, you know, and not realizing that there's this trade-off, and that trade-off is called money and how many hours it took you to acquire that money. So having them go through your thought process as you're making these big decisions and what the cost saving is to your household based on what decision you make is really important to illustrate to them. Basic banking, that's a really important one. If your children don't have a banking account of their own, get them started. And now this, you don't even have to wait for them to be teens. Get them involved in their money.
Right, and many banks offer, you know, special programs for kids where they don't have to have, you know, a lot of money deposited there, and there will be no fees, and there's educational stuff and connected website. So there are banks are in it to make money for themselves, but they also understand that their future clients will come from children. So many banks offer special, you know, a child's account, which would be might be more effective to use as a learning tool.
If they are earning money, this third tip is a good one, and that is have them commit at least 20% of their income to savings. And that may sound high, but you want them to get into the habit of not spending everything that they get. And this could be, you know, even gift money. Let's just say they're not at a working age yet, but maybe they've received gift money due to a birthday or a bar mitzvah or communion or what have you. Encourage them to save a portion of that. That discipline that you're going to hopefully instill in them will carry forward.
Right, or even, you know, using the checks as a savings. If they get a check for something, since they can't go to the store and purchase something, you know, you could set a rule in. That's what we do. If they get a check, all of it has to be saved. So it's also inconvenient for them to spend, so they could think of, okay, whenever I get a check, it's going to be saved. And usually when people give them cash, it's of smaller amounts, which obviously is not going, you know, which would be more preferable to spend rather than the larger amounts, which people usually will write checks for.
And you can help them use these savings to be earmarked for a longer-term goal so that they can start working toward things like buying their first car or supplementing their college spending money. So make sure you use this opportunity to do that with them. The fourth tip, budget. Most kids have no concept. Many adults don't have a concept of what a budget. Frankly, our government has difficulty with that concept. Have your children write down any money that they earn or receive from, you know, from you or others as gifts or allowance, and then have them look at where their money is going, what they're spending it on. And first and foremost, skim 20% right off the top. 20% of that budget has to go towards savings, so that, again, bakes it right into their process. And then what's left over, they can decide what to do with it.
Right, a reverse budget. You do your savings first and your spending after.
That's what we do in our household, frankly, and it seems to be better or easier for us to do it that way. I think most people would find it better than itemizing everything
else. It's less painful.
Yeah.
Once you put your money away, then you know you have freedom to spend the remainder, which is, I think, a more positive way to look at it.
The other thing is it gives them an opportunity to look at what they're spending and what they're spending it on and whether or not it's worth it. So these are important points. The fifth idea, maintenance, help them keep their budget on track by having them monitor what their behavior actually is once they've set up this budget. Just a good check and balance. Number six, earnings. If they want a bigger budget, they have to earn more. It's really very simple. You either have to increase your income or cut back your spending and or a combination of both. So get them motivated to become more creative in earning some money.
Right. Get a job, really. That's really a good positive.
And or start a business. There's more opportunity now for kids to do things like that. And finally, charity. It's always a good idea to have kids be aware of their blessings and to, you know, get dedicated to a cause that might speak to them and to be aware of other people and difficult situations that they could actually lend their hands to and their money to. So encourage them to donate. But, of course, the best lesson you can give them is to be organized yourself, pay your bills on time, and live within your means. Again, you set the right example. Hopefully they will follow. Okay. That actually combined the kids' cash corner today, too, because we kind of killed two birds with one stone going over the blog. Moving on to economics, oil prices. What is going on, Tony?
Oil prices. Yeah, well, most people see oil prices, and the biggest effect is obviously in their when they go buy gas for their car. And obviously it's been very positive because with the price of gas lower, people have more money to spend on other things. It also affects the world's economy because there are some countries which export a lot of oil. And obviously a lower price in exporting is not good because they receive less money and it affects their economy in a negative way. Other countries import more oil. And those countries are now receiving a big surplus in extra funds because they have to spend less to buy their imported oil. So overall, even though you might, you know, hear all kinds of complications that could happen with this price, overall it's a very positive development for the world economy because it's a product. When you spend less on one thing, you usually end up spending more on something else. So it's a net gain for most countries. And the reason why we haven't seen it as much right now in our own economy is because what's happening is people are kind of waiting to see if this is permanent. And, you know, if this is kind of like a permanently lower bill in which then they could reallocate that money to spend on other things. But since this has been a fairly recent development over the last year or so, the oil price coming down so much. A lot of people are still waiting to see if it's going to pretty much stay at this range for a while. And then you probably most likely will see a big boost in people spending money, consumer spending in our country, which could have a very positive effect on our economy because our economy is based on consumer spending. 70% of our economy is spending. So if people have more money in their pockets and they spend more, that could be very positive for economic growth and job creation. So, you know, you might see some headlines in the news up and down, what's happening with oil, and it could be very dangerous if you're an oil trader, which I certainly wouldn't advise you to do. But overall, a downward price of oil is a net positive for most people. So, you know, just it's been in the news a lot, so we figured we'd mention it.
Okay, this week's consumer tip, three ways to protect your beneficiaries. First of all, when you have an IRA, you would assign what would be called your beneficiaries, who that account would pass to in the event that you should pass away. And then you have contingent beneficiaries who are the backup to your beneficiaries. This is something that you need to review at least annually, and certainly more frequently if a family event, a life-changing event has occurred, such as the birth of a child, a death of a loved one, a divorce, for example. These are all things that would change who you may want to leave money to. So make it a habit to annually review these things. Perhaps tax time is a good time. April 15th, that date sticks out in people's heads. So make sure that you're checking that election every year. And it's just also a good idea when people assign their beneficiaries to really think about if something should happen to that beneficiary, where you'd want the money to go. So if you have a child and that child should pass away before you, where would you want that portion to go? Back to a sibling? Or if that child has children, would you want it to go to your grandchildren? And you would put what's called a per stirpes designation if you want it to go to your grandchildren.
And there's been many, you know, real-life complications with this. There have been people who have gotten married and had their wife as their beneficiary and then remarried and, you know, had more children and maybe, you know, now they have stepchildren also. And next thing you know, something happens to them. And now they might have not have changed their beneficiary. So now their ex-wife, who they possibly might hate intensely at this point, who knows, now is going to inherit that money. And there's really nothing you can do about it because it's what they call a will substitute. So it's a legal power for that person. If you didn't change it, that doesn't matter whether you like that person anymore or not. It's something that is going to happen. And you're you obviously you're dead, so you can't stop it, but your new wife cannot stop it either.
So make sure you check IRAs and also previous employer 401k or 403bs that you may have forgotten about. Again, you may have drafted those up quite a number of years ago and things may have changed, so please, please make sure that you're checking that. Second, get your will done or updated, and updating it for the exact same reasons that we just went over with the IRA. Not having a will can really significantly tie up an estate and make it that much more difficult, and can take a lot of time for your heirs to get to your...
Yeah, and also it would force the assets to go into something called probate, and it could be an extended period of time and also costly. Every state is different, but having a will just will make everyone's life a lot easier, whoever you're going to be as your beneficiaries or who you're going to leave your estate to. So not having a will is kind of an irresponsible thing to do, because it's going to put a lot of extra work for the people who are now in charge, who you wanted to leave the assets to, but now they're going to get probably less assets and have a lot more aggravation. And the will is pretty, you can get a simple will done. It's relatively inexpensive in the big picture, and it could put your mind at rest. So, you know, there really isn't any reason, you know, not to have a will if you have any assets that you would like to leave to your descendants.
And the third tip is something that we're recommending to people who either haven't had a chance to update their will or maybe don't have a will yet, and we say, look, you know, make sure you put some sort of protection, and that would be called transfer on death. You could add that to your bank accounts and to your taxable investments. And what that simply does, it's kind of like the beneficiary on an IRA. It's kind of the same thing. So if, God forbid, something should happen to you, the money would automatically pass without too much fanfare to whoever you've named as the transfer on death party. So those are three quick things you can do today to really make a difference.
Yeah, and, you know, we're trying to kind of put a monthly theme to each of our shows. So this month, if you kind of haven't noticed, it's been more of estate planning and tax issues. So, you know, the next show, next week, too, we'll probably deal with some other insurance and
some
other...
Yeah, we're looking at doing something on long-term care, annuities, things of that nature.
Yeah, so, you know, next month, you know, we're really going to focus on common investor mistakes, which we certainly could spend more than a month on. But we're trying to kind of organize this, and we're also going to be trying to focus the blogs and materials we send out on these topics. So hopefully they could supplement, if you're listening to the show, they could supplement the material. So we're trying to put some sort of, you know, organization to this, so it's more effective than just having random, you know, economic facts thrown at you.
And by all means, email us your questions. If there's anything that we can answer for you on the show, we'd be happy to. Chances are, if you're wondering it, there are tons of
other people
wondering
people
the very
same thing.
So you could email us, dina@atiinvestment.com. Okay, now we're up to the main event, decoding insurance, which is quite a headache, to be perfectly honest. We're often asked, how much insurance do I need, life insurance? What kind should I get? And it's a very complicated product, and oftentimes it's made more complicated by salespeople who try to recommend something that may or may not be really in your best interest.
Right, and the one thing, if you learn anything from this show, is separate your insurance from your investments. Think of your car insurance. You don't buy car insurance to make money. You don't buy home insurance to make money. You buy it to protect you against something bad and unexpected that's going to happen to you. So it's the same thing when you're buying different forms of insurance on your life. You're not looking to make money. Brokers and salespeople who are not fiduciaries, who are basically doing this job to gain commission dollars, will often push these products because it will pay them much more than selling a simple term life insurance, which most people need. So, always, rule number one, separate your investments from insurance. You can put aside money to pay a relatively inexpensive term life policy and use what's left over that you were going to use to pay those additional unnecessary premium amounts into a low-cost investment, and you'll get the best of both worlds. You'll have more than adequate insurance coverage, and you'll also have investment growth. Whereas when you combine those two products, most of the time we have found you get the worst of both worlds, because you will be inadequately insured, because it's very expensive. These products are very expensive. And to get a lot of insurance coverage, you have to pay an enormous premium, which most people can't afford. So number one, you're not properly insured. And number two, because of all the high costs, your investment returns are very subpar. So, you know, the people that are trying to sell you these products have vested interests, and it is their interest to sell them to you because they're making a lot of money from you. You have no interest, in most cases, to buy these products.
So just to recap on that, whole life is expensive, often isn't going to give you the adequate coverage you need.
No.
Term can get you coverage that will be much more reasonable.
Right. Well, think about it. I mean, if you have two people and you want to get adequate insurance for 10 years and you have a couple of children, and say your net combined income is $100,000, you need to replace $100,000. At least for 10 years. So that's $1 million right there. Now if you're talking about using that to pay off a mortgage also and provide for college funding, you could be talking another $1 million. So getting a $2 million life insurance policy is often a very wise choice for a family with children, and you'll be adequately insured, and you'll be surprised at the cost. It's very cost effective if you're in, you know, relatively decent health and, you know, at an age where the insurance companies look at you as a low-risk, you know, prospect. Now, go back to the whole life, you know, it would cost you, thousands of dollars a year in premiums just to get maybe $150,000 or $200,000 over that same, you know, over this period. Now, yes, that will stay with you, and you'll get that it won't end as a term, but think of the value of what you're getting. If something happened to you, what really is $200,000 going to accomplish if you intended for that insurance to last for 10 or 20 years? And people don't seem to ask that question. What happens usually is people will be misled by the salesman saying, well, you'll get insurance, and also, you know, the cash value will build up, so you'll get these excellent investment returns. And that is just not true, because it's impossible to get the excellent investment returns because these products are extremely expensive. And like I said before, you'll be inadequately insured. And very few insurance salesmen will push term life insurance, even though that's best for probably 95% of all Americans. And the simple reason for that is they will be paid a much higher commission for selling you the inexpensive and underinsured whole life insurance.
Is there a good formula that you would use to calculate what you think would be?
I think
good coverage.
Like I said, I think what income you want to replace plus other goals you're expecting to be. So if you within that time frame. So if you want to cover college and also cover paying off a mortgage, take those two numbers, take an estimate of those, and add it to those, you know, two salaries. That's why, you know, there are people who buy, you know, you see these ridiculous ads to buy insurance on your child. That's one of the stupidest things you could ever imagine, because you're replacing income. What child is making income that you're living on? So it makes no sense. Insurance is there to replace income. So why would you buy insurance on a child who is not working? It's like a single person having insurance. Unless they need to take care of a relative, a mother or something, but if everybody else in their family is fine, they don't need insurance either, because it's designed for them, for the survivors who might need it. So always, again, if you think of insurance for what it is, insurance, you'll make better decisions. If you let these people confuse you by co-mingling insurance and investments, that's where you're going to have a very big problem on your hands. So don't let that happen.
To get off the topic just a hair, I think a lot of people are worried about things such as being disabled and maybe being alive, but maybe not being able to provide in the manner that they had. What would you recommend to someone in that position? Is disability insurance?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a much better chance of you being disabled than you being killed. Those are the statistics. So especially if your job is physically dangerous and you're not covered by your, you know, organization that you work for, disability insurance should actually come before the life insurance, because the odds of it occurring are higher. And, you know, that's a whole other topic, which we can maybe, you know, talk about a little more next week. But, yes, without a doubt, you know, most people don't even think about disability insurance. But for the odds of it, of you being disabled, are much higher than you dying.
And so for someone self-employed, even if it's not a physical job, disability insurance would become a pretty important thing to get.
Sure.
We have about 4 minutes left.
Okay.
On today's show. Perhaps we can go into annuities a little bit, because that's certainly a related product, and people sometimes are using type of insurance on their investment, which is not something we typically recommend. Annuity products of that type have their place, but for a select few.
There are annuities that are useful. There are things called fixed annuities, which you basically transfer the risk to an insurance company. In exchange for a lump sum of money, you'll get a payment for the rest of your life. And these are pretty easy to understand and might make sense when you're older for a portion of your income, so you know you'll cover your basic needs. But the other types of annuities, called variable annuities, often are very inefficient vehicles because they're very expensive. You're paying for a tax deferral, which you automatically get in your 401k or 403b or IRA, and over time, the investment options, the cost of those investment options, will take away a tremendous amount of your returns than if you just basically took that money again and invested it in a low-cost index fund or something of that nature. And again, mixing insurance and investments is a bad idea, because most variable annuities are sold because they'll tell people, well, you'll always get your money back. That's the insurance. But you're paying a huge price to do that. And if you have a long-term time horizon for your money, there has never been a 20-year period where you have lost money investing in a broad stock market index. And never mind if you diversify into bonds also, but I'm saying if you're a very risky person, put 100% of your money in stocks, in 20-year period, there's never been a period where you lost money. So now you're paying for all of this extra insurance for this guarantee that you don't need. If you're so worried about losing money, then maybe you should invest less aggressively, and that would be a much better alternative than this false promise of, okay, you'll get all your money back, so pay 4% a year for this privilege and make no return over 20 years. So you really need to watch out with these products, because the people who usually deal with these products are pure salespeople for the most part, and you know, you can just do a Google search and find, you know, all the different fines and all the different, you know, things that have happened to people with both whole life insurance and variable annuities, and it's just not a pretty picture.
The good news is, though, if you do find yourself in one of these expensive products, you can do a 1035 exchange out of the annuity and into something more reasonably priced.
Right. So there's always hope, but you have to be educated to realize what's happening, and most people will go their lifetime without having that knowledge.
Okay, so we have just a little bit of time left. Let's just do a quick recap of some things that we hope that you walked away with today. One is, we hope you'll have a good dialogue with teenagers about money, and hope you understand oil prices a little bit better now.
Yeah, and if they fall, that's usually pretty good.
And obviously, we hope that now you know a little bit more about what to do with your estate planning and protecting your beneficiaries by updating your will and your beneficiary information. And lastly, make sure that you review your insurance needs versus your coverage and get right on that, because that's not something you want to be caught without.
Right, and just again, always separate your investments from your insurance. When you combine the two, that's usually the root of all evil in that business.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this week. We look forward to hearing from you via email. And remember to like and visit us on our different blog sites. Have a wonderful rest of the week. Thanks for joining us.